Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy 4th of July week. It's going to be not the 4th of July when you hear this, as that was yesterday, and we haven't had it recorded yet, but it was relatively recently.
Welcome to the biggest wasted week in the calendar when 4th of July is on a Wednesday.
It's a lot. It's so rough. Like, today felt like a Monday, but tomorrow's Friday. It's just like a weird, it just felt very weird today.
Yeah, we really just should have taken the week off.
Yeah, just punt on this week.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, we can't punt on everything, though, because admittedly, we are, you know, fully kind of in the throes of Syracuse football previews. On Tuesday, I wrapped up our opponent previews that we started back in April. Camp should be starting in a few weeks. And Dan, Syracuse's quarterback situation is pretty damn good right now. And, you know, Brent Axe and I were talking about it on the radio today, actually. It's tough to really compare to, like, the 1998 situation that Dino Babers brought up. But nonetheless, like, this is a really promising group. And I think for the first time in a while, there's not necessarily this sense of panic, you know, about what happens if Eric Dungy gets injured. And I know you and I have talked about this a little bit, but figured, you know, while we're getting into the preview stuff, might as well discuss it a little bit more and reacclimate everybody with the quarterback situation on the roster.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a pretty advantageous spot with the quarterbacks. Obviously, I think we hope that we don't need to go much past Eric Dungy, aside from, like, getting Tommy DeVito some work in if we're up big, or I guess down big, hypothetically. But overall, like, I think we're pretty comfortable with the first three guys on the depth chart, which is a really nice place to be. There are not very many college football programs that can say that. Because even Rex Culpepper, I mean, obviously he's recovering from his cancer battle, which he seems to be on the right end of now. But, like, I thought he looked pretty good last year. And if he's your third-string quarterback behind one of the better quarterbacks in the league, plus, you know, a really highly touted redshirt freshman, I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, same. I mean, you know, we've discussed, like, everybody has been willing to kind of move DeVito, you know, right ahead of Culpepper on the depth chart since DeVito arrived on campus. And while, yeah, you know, the recruiting numbers might bear that out, like, Culpepper really didn't do half bad last year. I mean, he threw for a decent amount of yards. He had, what, I think over 500. He had 280 in that one game against Boston College to end the season. He completed 60% of his passes. He threw two touchdown passes. Like, no, those aren't, like, you know, record-setting numbers by any means, but he obviously was gaining more and more command of the offense as the season went on. He was prone to some mistakes here and there, but, you know, most players thrown into their first bit of action usually are. I think that, you know, don't want to necessarily sell him short. I don't necessarily know what Dino Babers and the staff see in terms of action for him, given the fact that he's recovering from chemo. Obviously, he's practicing already with the team, but, you know, you don't want to rush somebody back from something like that, so we'll see what his availability looks like. But between, again, you know, him and DeVito alone, I think DeVito probably a little bit more accurate on paper, at least, than Culpepper. I think in, you know, spring practice, he was able to fit stuff into some pretty tight windows. It seemed like he was pretty accurate, you know, in spring game action. I think in general, a lot of people like his upside. I think, though, again, I think Culpepper, if he can put a little less air under the ball in certain cases, he did seem like a pretty accurate passer. Dungy, obviously, is going to be your starter, though, and it's all going to depend on this offensive line in front of him. So we'll get to the offensive line in a few weeks, but for now, I do think that Dungy ends up being a much, much more accurate passer this year because he has you know, time in the pocket and has an offensive line that's going to be able to protect him, when last year it was a little bit younger of a unit and not necessarily the most experienced one either.
And he's going to year three of a system where a lot of these guys have come up in it, since we're going to have, I think, a pretty good array of young, skill position players around him. It's just like, you know, this should be the time where this program starts to meld under where Babers' offense is, even with, like, a pretty new, young crop of receivers, because they're guys that were coming in and recruited for this system in particular. You know, hopefully we have the schemes well, drawn up well, and we're, you know, getting guys open that way. And overall, I think Dungy's always been, you know, I don't know that he has, like, the perfect, like, ball-for-ball accuracy, but I think generally, like, his accuracy has been relatively good. And he just, like, overall, like, while he can be a little bit of a risk-taker, makes pretty good decisions with the ball most of the time. So, yeah, I think he's one of the most excited players in the league. Hopefully we can finally get a full year out of him. I feel pretty good about the fact that he's not coming off of head injuries. It's, you know, other stuff this time, but it should be fully, you know, good to go for the season. So, I think it's nice if you're going to have one position that's like a verifiable strength compared to the rest of the conference, you'd probably pick quarterback. So, you know, if you had really great quarterback play all year, it'll take Syracuse pretty far. So hopefully we get the full season out of Dungy. We get to see a little bit of what DeVito can do. Culpepper, obviously his health is the most important thing, but I think we, you know, all are pretty high on him in terms of, you know, at least a depth guy, if not more. So overall, like, it's pretty easy to be bullish on this group.
Yeah, I mean, I really like what Dungy, has done in most of his time at Syracuse, but I think under Babers, he's shown an ability to make great decisions. There are some, you know, moments where maybe that's not the case. Weather's been a factor. Injuries have been a factor. I think last year, to be honest, like, you saw some of those numbers get derailed a bit from an accuracy standpoint once he sustained the ankle injury. I think once he started taking too many hits, you and I talked about it in season, how just over time, you know, if you're getting hit 15, 20 times a game as a quarterback, like, at some point it's going to take its toll, whether it's, you know, on your legs, on your arms, shoulders, your throwing motion, hand, whatever. Like, you know, and Dungy took his licks yet again last year. I think this year, having that protection in front of him, and hopefully he's able to really follow through on that, you know, promise to run a little bit less, or at least run a little bit safer, that's where he can become a more accurate passer. I think with the extra protection, you should be able to see both quicker and more accurate throws, but also let plays develop here and there. I think last year, one of the biggest problems for Dungy and every Syracuse quarterback that hit the field was allowing those deeper routes to develop. Steve Ishmael was not necessarily a deep threat. Jamal Custis was never really on the field enough to become a deep threat. Irv's not a deep threat. So you had this lack of ability to really get defenders away from the line of scrimmage, and we saw as the season wore on, opposing defenders were able to really kind of, you know, stack things within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage because, you know, so few of those passes were going beyond the 5-10 yard mark. You had a couple of big gains here and there, but that was really it. Like last year, SU averaged 6.5 yards per completion versus it was 7.4 the year before. So that's a pretty steep dip. It doesn't seem like it from just a pass-to-pass standpoint, but over the course of the season, if you complete 300 passes, gaining 0.9 fewer yards per does really add up pretty quickly.
Yeah, I part of that's because the offensive line struggles, but I also think Amba was, you know, such a really ridiculous deep threat. And he, obviously Ishmael put together an awesome season last year, as did Irv, but they weren't the same kind of player, so just the team wasn't, the dynamics of the receiving core last year wasn't kind of built for that. But overall, like, you want to see, especially yards per completion, you definitely want to see higher than like in the sixes, even with an offense like this that can, you know, get a bunch of quick hitters.
Yeah, I think this year's offense is going to be interesting, and you and I have mentioned this before, like, you have a lot of options. None of them are necessarily all that proven, but that could be an advantage for Dungy or whoever else is throwing the football, because now you don't have this clear kind of line from to one or two receivers. 2 years ago, you know, Editawo and Phillips caught, you know, the lion's share of the passes. They caught, you know, over 180 passes between the two of them. Last year, Steve Ishmael and Irvin Phillips combined for, you know, over 190 receptions. Like, while it's great to have players that can do that, it also makes your offense fairly one-dimensional. We saw that at the end of the year, especially when, you know, Zach Mahoney, Rex Culpepper were under center. There really wasn't anybody else to throw the ball to. So I think this year, you know, Ravian Pierce should be one of the best tight ends in the conference. That's going to be interesting to see, you know, how he factors in, since the system doesn't necessarily cater to tight ends as passing targets. Obviously, we've got Devin Butler, who's experienced but inconsistent. Custis, we'll see if he can stay healthy. Nakeem Johnson got some burn last year, and I think he could be an interesting Irvin Phillips replacement. You know, Sherrod Johnson, Cameron Jordan, Sean Riley, RTB, like, these are all guys who we're going to see the field. Ed Hendricks, probably one of the only true freshman receivers who could potentially see the field this year. But there are a lot of options out there, and I really hope that this offense starts spreading the ball around a little bit more, because that's going to make it more versatile. Like, I'd rather have one guy catch maybe 50 to 60 passes and then have another, you know, 3 to 4 guys you can catch 20 to 30, and I think that might make for a more interesting passing game.
No, I totally agree. I think I mean, that's what we're going to need, just because I don't think we're going to get that dominant performance. And someone might, you know, step up and prove us wrong. We obviously didn't.
Last 2 years it worked.
Yeah, I mean, Ishmael, like, we thought would be good. We didn't think it was going to be what it was. But, you know, so maybe Ravian Pierce turns in a 1,300-yard season and...
go for it, man.
And this sounds stupid, but overall, like, I think it's more likely that we're doing the more well-rounded, you know, everyone's chipping in. You have, you know, a number of different guys who can, depending on matchups, play a big factor. It just seems more likely based on what we know right now. So, yeah, no, I think that would definitely be a good thing, because you want to keep defenses off, you know, unbalanced and unsure of who the ball's going to versus the last couple of years. Like, while the receivers, you know, won those battles a lot of the time, you know, you still want to keep the defense on its toes.
You know who's one guy on the roster who would really pay a lot of dividends this year is Tristan Jackson. Now, he can't play this season, but... You know, he's a speedy guy, 6'1", like 185, 190 pounds. Like, he's somebody who I kind of wish we had access to this year, because I feel like he'd be able to plug right in and be your kind of Ishmael replacement and be on the outside, catch 80 to 90 balls. We'll have to wait on him for next year, but yeah, definitely think he might be the best suited for this role that we've seen in the past. So maybe, just maybe, like, not having him this year could pay dividends next year, even if things look a little rough around the edges for the first part, a few games this season, as we figure out kind of who our primary targets are.
Yeah, I buy that. I think we know a lot about this offense in terms of, I mean, the offensive line is a pretty well-known commodity at this point. Obviously, quarterback is a very well-known commodity. Receiver, you know, we've been talking about it a lot this offseason. That's really where most of the questions are, and there are a lot of answers. It's just a matter of finding the right ones. Like, we've named, you know, how many guys in this podcast already. It's just finding, like, kind of the right grouping. And I chose Neighbors to do that, because he's done that everywhere he's been. So I'm not super worried about it. And overall, like, if you have the quarterback, I think that's, like, the number one place to start. So with Dungy, I think we're in pretty good hands.
Yeah, I'd agree. You know who else could play an interesting part in the passing game? And I'm really kind of... I think we saw glimpses of it last year. Dante Strickland, a guy who I've regularly nominated to move to receiver, not for his lack of ability at running back, just because I think he's better suited for it. I think, you know, Baber's system hasn't necessarily used a ton of passing out of the backfield, if only because, like, usually they have 4 and 5 wide receivers out there. You don't necessarily need to start with a target that's behind the line of scrimmage when you have 4 guys, you know, just kind of streaking down the field. But I think what we saw out of Strickland as a receiver last year is enough to make me think that we see a little bit more of that, and a little more of the running backs getting involved in the pass game this year.
Yeah, and I think it made sense for him to be involved in the passing game, particularly because he is also the best blocker of that group. So you can kind of have him in there without telling, you know, whether he's in a leak out from the backfield or stay in the block, because he is probably the most versatile guy outside of just running the ball.
I would agree. And we'll get more into running backs next week, so I don't want to give away too much there. Talking a little bit more about just Syracuse stuff in general before we get into the Big 12 preview that we'll be inhabiting the second half of this podcast. Demetrius Nichols joined the roster for Boeheim's Army, and I think that this team is going to be very interesting and very entertaining. I think they might just need another pure big man, but otherwise, I really like this group this summer.
Yeah, I think they've been learning, like, kind of what works in this tournament. And Nichols is an interesting addition. Obviously, he provides some extra outside shooting. He's interesting because he's, like, kind of outside of the general group of players that we've been going from. It's mostly been, like, the 2010 to 2000, like, till, like, the most recent guys.
Right.
So he's a little older. I don't think he's played with Bam's Army before, has he? He's brand new. I know he had some older guys.
2015, he was there.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I thought he might be. But overall, it's a nice addition. I think shooting's always good. When they were hinting at it, I was kind of hoping for Routins, which I think is, like, the one guy who has, like, been not really floated by anyone associated with the team, but it's, like, the one guy who hasn't played with Boeheim's Army yet who you, like, would kind of like to see. But Nichols, you know, fills the role pretty well, too. But it is interesting with him being a slightly older guy.
Yeah, I mean, between him and Warwick, like, the two of them should become the elder statesmen of the team. I think, you know, like you said, like, one of the biggest benefits for us is that there are so many guys who played together, either, like, in practice as, like, one of them was coming into the program, the other one was leaving, or, like, enough of these guys hang around Syracuse. Obviously, Devo's with the team now. So it becomes this really kind of cohesive group. And because so many of them return year after year, that I really like where they stack up comparatively. I mean, there's plenty of other alumni teams, but I still think Syracuse does play that part of things really well. There was good news for us, at least last week. I know I forgot his name, but Overseas Elite's coach is no longer with the team. And Overseas Elite has been kind of everybody's nemesis through the last three or four years.
Three-time
reigning champs of basketball tournament.
Yeah, so I don't know how much of an impact he has directly, right. But obviously I think the three-time defending champs would rather have their coach than not, considering, you know, he's been there the whole time. So, yeah, I think that was pretty good news, considering we are one of the main rivals for them to four-peating. So, yeah, I was definitely not too upset about seeing that.
No.
Granted, I have no idea how he is coached. Like, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I mean, most of these guys are grown adults on a temporary team. I don't necessarily think they need too much interference on the coach's front, but
it's also like not super reasonable to like assume a coach can like get that much done in how short a period of time these like training camps are. Like, obviously, you want to like draw some quick stuff up, but it's not like, you know, you're installing this like month-long system.
No, I mean, and that's the other, you know, really good thing from a cohesion standpoint for Boeheim's Army is that there is this system that kind of spans across several generations of players that you don't really have to try very hard to implement. You know, if you're Ryan Blackwell, like, all you just kind of go, all right, like, play the zone that you know how to play and just make sure that everyone's still up on it. And then you just kind of, you know, proceed while everybody else, you're not going to implement a really like complicated system, but you're still going to have to maybe get everybody's habits in line with one another's while I feel like at least with Boeheim's Army, everybody's habits are already there. It's just a question of like waking them up.
I feel pretty good about it. So we're like in, I mean, what year of this are we in now? And it's the fourth year, I think, that we've had teams.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like we, at this point, we kind of know who the teams are, and it's like, you know, I'd say like 2/3 of the same roster. So I think year over year, I mean, we definitely saw it last year, like the team really came together. So it's definitely been a growing thing. Hopefully we can finally win this damn tournament.
I really hope, you know what, I do think that we have enough shooters this time. Like,
yeah,
if you just look up and down the roster, like, we have distributors, we have shooters, like, there are, like, I mean, like you said, Routens is really the only guy missing from Routens, and like, I maybe Cooney, like, good Trevor Cooney, not hair pulling Trevor Cooney, but like having, you know, Devendorf, Gillen, Sutherland, Demetrius Nichols, like having all those guys on the roster, like, that's a really good group from like mid-range to outside. And there's probably not a lot of teams in this field that have that many shooters. Plus, you know, having Paul Harris this time around and his size, having Chris Joseph, having Hakeem Warwick, having Deshaunte Riley in the middle, you know, having Trish as a distributor, like, that to me, like, just, this seems like on paper, one of the, if not the most well-constructed team they've had so far.
Yeah, I think every year the roster construction has gotten better as we've learned like more about what works. Now, I do wonder if the what the impact of the change system to the I can't remember, we talked about it a week ago.
The Elam ending thing.
The Elam ending. I do wonder, like, if I guess, well, the way it's constructed, there shouldn't be a huge change. Although maybe it emphasizes 3-point shooting a little bit more because you can kind of end the game a little quicker. But
right.
Overall, like, I do wonder if that has a major impact, but, you know, it's tough to tell until we've actually seen it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not going to extrapolate out. I know that some people noticed last week that Georgetown lost in round one.
Oh, I actually missed that. That's amazing. Good for them.
Like, of course you did. Just keeping up traditions. Keeping up with traditions and just making sure you don't ruin anybody else's
team. They were playing the St. John's was playing the Marquette team.
I think they played St. Hall's team. They might have lost.
How did they get thrown in a play-in game?
Well, because they did. They did this because they seeded, the committee seeded everybody and didn't have the voting this time around.
So did they kind of screw those teams over?
Yeah. So they basically, yeah, they basically set up like a, like they set up like a Big East like mini bracket for play-in games.
I would guess the Marquette team probably is. I don't know if they won or not. I didn't pay attention the first weekend. But the Marquette team like has been in it more, so I think they probably have the biggest argument to be annoyed. Georgetown, I don't think, had a team last year. And if they did, they didn't do anything, so
no,
who cares?
They did not. There,
I don't believe they did. And I think some of those players were in it, but
I know that there were, yeah, there were like a couple like random play-in brackets where you had like the West Regional pod that was pretty much like West Coast Conference plus Utah and Air Force. Then you had, they decided to make a Big East like regional pod to just like screw over all these teams. And so,
which is, I don't know if it's the best strategy for the tournament, because like the alumni team seemed to be like the biggest draw, but I'm not going to argue with screwing over Georgetown.
Or any of the Big East teams.
I'm always
really
for that. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that Marquette team scares the hell out of me, so I'm okay with like giving them extra games.
Yeah, and they're in our bracket, actually.
Yeah, I know. Again, I don't know if they won last week or not. I
they did. Seton Hall beat Georgetown, which is like really bad team. Like, who came up with these names? Like, I get why Georgetown's Jack Attack, but that's still stupid. Seton Hall was Hall In, and no.
That's not good.
No. Marquette's just the Golden Eagles, didn't even try. And then St. John's just the Johnnies. That's a nice throwback reference, I guess. And yeah, then Marquette smoked Seton Hall in the final.
That makes sense. I think that Marquette team is like pretty good. I remember them from last year because I think it's most of the same guys. It's like all those Buzz Williams players.
Yeah, so they're going to be good. Then they also did like a random South Regional thing, and that's really it. Yeah, I mean, if I was the Big East teams, I'd be pretty pissed off, but whatever. They also did the Big East Northeast pod in at Marquette.
Yeah, I remember seeing like highlights being at Marquette, so at least they got that.
Yeah, so like, yeah, they decided to give Marquette a couple like home games. Or you know, have them play Wisconsin and then not call it, and then not remark that they haven't left the state of Wisconsin for weeks on end. You know, those types of things.
It is weird that we have such a big layoff, because it's like a couple of weeks now until Syracuse plays, right?
Yeah, we don't play until like the 21st.
Yeah, that's. I was confused because I saw like the first game coming up. People were like, a couple people tweeted at me like asking what, if I was going to the Dams. I'm like, wait, is that this weekend?
No.
I was very relieved that it was not.
I will actually not even be around for the first weekend of games. I will be taking a slight vacation to Palm Springs.
Nice. So I will hopefully get to those games in Brooklyn, at least the Sunday games, if we, you know, assume we make it through the Saturday or the Friday or whatever it is.
We better. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. I'm not super worried about it. I think we have a relatively easy draw early.
Agreed. Yeah, I didn't see the exact team, but we should be fine. I'm not too worried about the early rounds. Famous last words, but
yeah.
Anyway, more basketball while we're here in the first half of things. There's been some NBA free agency movements. Jeremy Grant didn't sign as big of a deal as we probably thought he would, but he did re-sign with OKC. He'll be back on a 3-year, $27 million deal. That's pretty awesome for him, and I think it speaks pretty highly to the type of athlete he is, but also to the fact that Syracuse can keep players in the league. It had been a while, obviously, like Deion Waiters is just considered by everyone to not really be... He doesn't belong to anyone. He's just Deion Waiters. He just belongs to Deion University. But obviously Deion signed a really big deal. I think people associate him less with Syracuse. They try to associate the bad stuff with Syracuse, but not the good stuff. I feel like with Jeremy Grant, people actually admit that he did go to Syracuse, which is fine at me. We mentioned that Melo opted in.
He's on a net wave, though.
He's definitely going to get... Is he going to get stretched, though? You think they're just going to try to negotiate a buyout?
It sounds like they'll probably stretch him, because I think if they stretch him, they'll save...
Like $90 million.
Like, a ridiculous amount of money on that luxury tax bill that they owe,
yeah.
Which is insane for that team, but...
Yeah, that's not the market to have a luxury tax bill like that.
No, it's not the market, it's not the roster.
Right, yeah. Like, you're... Especially now, like, you're not making the finals, so...
It's not a bad roster, but it's not the roster to pay $300 million for.
If I'm OKC, I try to use the savings to bribe Silver to put us in like the Southeast Division. Just swap us out with like Atlanta or something. Nobody will notice.
I mean, really, it should be Memphis, and I've thought about this a lot. It should be Memphis and I think
New Orleans,
Minnesota, maybe that it swapped.
I know. Well, yeah. Well, Memphis, Milwaukee needs to be in the West.
Or maybe that's it. It's Memphis should be in the East and Milwaukee should be in the West.
Yeah, that's really like the big one, just because Memphis has to spend so much time on the road. I mean, the one good thing, at least for the NBA, is that you don't really play a ton of divisional games anyway. So, like, it's not as bad as hockey was at one point, where, like, when they had the six division hockey structure, where like Dallas was in the Pacific Division and would have to play like 8 games a year against like the Kings, the Ducks, and they spent all their game. I mean, when Detroit, when the Red Wings were in the Western Conference, there they'd have to play so many games. You know, I mean, Detroit's Eastern Time Zone, and they'd have to play so many games on Pacific Time that like their fans couldn't even watch most of their games.
Yeah, that's brutal. And also, just like in the NBA, no one cares about the divisions at all. Like,
yeah,
they care about individual rivalries like sometimes, but I feel like the rivalries outside of like Celtics, Lakers, and even that, like, it all depend on who's there. But like, they switch from year to year based on like the teams, but not like, it's not like the franchises have these crazy rivalries that last forever. So
yeah, there's a couple of regional ones, like the Nets and Knicks try.
That, yeah, because they're right there.
Yeah, and like the Knicks fans hate the Celtics. The Celtics don't care about the Knicks.
Like, as a Nets fan, like growing up through like Jason Kidd years, there were like different times where like the Pacers, Sixers, and Celtics all felt like rivals. But then, like, you know, the teams completely change, and you know, some fall out of contention, some come in contention, and then it's like it's based on like the like set of years. So like right now you have that Wizards Celtics thing, but like in a couple of years, no one will care about that.
Right. No, I mean, because of when I grew up, like, I still hate the Miami Heat and I still hate the Pacers, just as a Knicks fan. But like, yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody on those teams, I don't think most rational fans, and I wouldn't really consider myself to be in that group, would really care much about the Heat or Pacers anymore.
Right. Until, like, you know, a couple, you know, the right set of players gets there, and then you play in the playoffs a couple times in a row, and then it becomes a thing, and it just, like, ebbs and flows, except for a couple of these rivalries, like, obviously Celtics-Lakers.
Totally. But yeah, if Melo decides, well, if Melo gets waived or stretched, where do you see him signing? Because the most likely destination that people have pointed out, the Lakers, doesn't really seem like they have the money to bring him in the door anymore.
They don't have the money because they, I mean, I don't really,
they wasted it on Rajon Rondo.
I don't mind those signings because they're all for 1 year, but and I also don't think Melo would have been a good fit for that team because right. It seems like they're going to try to play more up-tempo still. Like, I don't think they're going to change their whole system for LeBron. It sounds like they're going to try to play how they're playing.
Well, obviously not. They decided to sign all of his enemies on one roster.
Yeah, but also, like, they're not signing, like, it's not, they're not building this team like the old LeBron Cavs teams. Right. They're building it like the way they were already building it, plus they added LeBron, so... I don't expect this to be like a slow down half court team. No. And Melo can't play in like a pace, and I wouldn't even call it pace and space, but because there's no spacing on that team right now. But I don't think Melo's going to be able to play with, you know, the way that like Lonzo Ball's going to run the team. It just doesn't fit. So I don't know. Like, it's tough to really project because he had such a weird year this year, and he's such a specific skill set. But I assume he'll want to go to a contender.
Like, who's got the rooms? I mean, like, yeah, not to, like, harp on the Lakers, but, like, the Lakers couldn't have fit Melo for one. Two, they really should have kept Randall for the same price as Rondo, but whatever. I mean, like, the Bulls have room, but they're not a contender.
And they're not going to want to add Melo. No. Like, it doesn't make sense. It'll probably be the Kings. They'll probably end up a King, which will suck. They're like a handful of teams with cap room. But they're all, like, I don't think any of them are, like, super contenders right now.
I've tried to make the case that the Knicks
apparently SpotRack has a cap space thing.
No.
I didn't realize. SpotRack's like sneakily one of the most useful websites.
Oh, I love anywhere that tells me what like salary information, because the NBA salary situation needs to be broken down like by a scientist for anyone to like really figure out what's going on.
So there are 8 teams right now with any that are in the pot, like have any cap space, practical. What's SpotRack's calling practical cap space.
Right.
So which of these makes sense? The Bulls? No.
No.
The Hawks? No.
No.
The Kings? It would be a very Kings thing to do.
Oh, extremely Kings.
The Pacers is interesting.
It's not going to fit.
I don't think it's a great fit, but at least...
Oladipo needs the ball.
Yeah. He would have to be... The other problem is, like, does he want to be a role player? The Mavericks have cap space. I don't think it's fit.
No, the Mavs want to contend.
The Suns have cap space. It's absolutely not a fit.
That's the thing. The Mavs and Suns, I mean, the Suns need to contend because they've told themselves they need to contend. The Mavs need to contend because if they don't, they're forfeiting that pick in the lottery. So, like, they need, I mean, Kings too, to be honest. Like, Kings and Dallas might actually do it. Well, Kings will do it because they want to trick themselves into contending. Dallas could actually contend right now if they make like one more savvy signing, yeah, like an 8 seed.
Yeah, I think Dallas is going to be sneakily one of the most interesting teams in the league this year. And then the last two teams that have any cap space, but it's very little, are the Lakers and the 76ers. The Sixers would be interesting.
That would never happen.
I don't think it will happen, and I think the fit there would be like coming in second unit when they're slowing it down, because like he's not going to play on that. Like, I just don't see him fitting alongside what that like Simmons-led team is right now. But in the half court, you know, I think it'd be interesting. I don't see any of those happening.
Then bring him the Knicks. Sign in, like, let's. I want to see what would make this happen, because I want to see it happen. Like, either trade Cantor back, or
oh, they're never trading Cantor back.
No, they're not. But the better option to me, trade Hardaway. Hardaway and Lee have 2 years, including this coming season, left on their salaries. That adds up to about $26 million. Send that to Oklahoma City for a like second rounder and like whoever's at the back end of their bench who's already on like a 1 year deal.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think the Knicks thing just ended so like I just can't see him wanting to go back like at this point based on how things ended.
Oh, I agree with that, but I think he'd rather if he's only going to spend 1 year somewhere. I think he'd rather go to New York than Sacramento.
You would hope, because it's still bored.
Yeah,
Sacramento is just where like. Everything goes to die.
I've spent a decent amount of time in Sacramento, and I can concur.
Poor Lady Bird.
Anyway, why don't we do a little halftime, and then we can get into the Big 12 football talk that, you know, half the listeners aren't going to want to hear about.
Cool.
So what have you been drinking?
I had a decent amount over the holiday, the weekend / the holiday. Like, you might want to say a holiday weekend because it feels like it was. It
right.
wasn't. It's stupid calendar. So let's see. What did I have that was unique? I had a Molotov cocktail from Evil Twin, which I believe I've brought up before. It's like a pretty strong, I think they call it triple IPA. I know it's not like actually a thing, but that's what they call it. And it's, you know, what you would imagine, just very, very high, you know, impact, flavorful, really full flavor, you know, complex. I had a Beach from Doza from Blue Point, which was actually very good, super refreshing. I'm not usually, I feel like the last couple of times I've actually had like hit pretty well with Blue Point, when the first couple stuff things I had from them I wasn't a huge fan of, but I thought this was quite good. And also like plum was like an interesting flavor you don't usually see with beers. I had Honey Spot Road IPA, which I bring up a decent amount for Two Roads. I had a double IPL from Von Trapp Brewing, which was really good.
Great reference.
Yes. That's up in Vermont. I had it up in, I was in Saratoga for a day, just on a whim, visiting people for the 4th. I had a couple things from Peak Still. Their Simple Sour was fine. It, you know, pretty run-of-the-mill sour. And then I had their Big Big Love, which was a farmhouse Saison. You know, pretty solid Saison. Nothing, like, crazy. I had a Pineapple Bombo from Chatham Brewing. Which I believe is Massachusetts, I imagine. Really good. The pineapple flavor was like really well balanced with the double IPA, which was nice. And then I think the best thing I had this week was the Smash 009 Turo and Nelson Sauvin from Upstate Brewing, which I had earlier in the week watching some of the World Cup games. That was, they do like a long, I guess they have a running like set of these IPAs with various different hop varietals. This one was really, really delicious. And one of the first things I've had from Upstate, which is in Elmira. And I don't usually find their stuff down here, but this was really delicious. So if you see that, it said it was out of production when I looked on Untappd, but one bar from me by me had it in New York City. So you could probably find it somewhere. And this was really, really good.
Nice. I had a decent amount of stuff myself. I had a bottle of St. Arnold Pumpkinator sitting around. I thought, why not give it a shot? Definitely not the right season for it, but still worked out. Had some Little Bo Pills from Smog City. Grabbed a six-pack of Luponic Distortion from Firestone Walker. Super, super good. They have their kind of quarterly IPA release that they, you know, try out different hops with, different flavor profiles. This one was just extremely light, like only 5.9% ABV, super fresh, like German and Australian hops, kind of tasted like mango and peach and grapefruit, like a lot of really bright flavors, summery flavors going on. This was like infinitely crushable to grab some beer blogging parlance. Definitely recommend this one to anyone who's in the Firestone Walker distro area, because again, super, super good. I'll definitely be grabbing more of this while it's still fresh out there. I know I got this one within a few weeks of bottling, and definitely did not disappoint. What else did I have? I had a Pivo Pils from Firestone, because I had some of that sitting around. Went over to Smog City. I mention them all the time. They're down in Torrance. They have a new patio at the brewery, so now there's like a little bit of outdoor space. Bring the dogs, kind of hang out. So tried a bunch of new stuff I hadn't had from them in a while. Had a gift card, actually, that my sister had gotten me for my birthday back in January, and I finally got to finish it out. So got a couple flights, got a new T-shirt, had a pale lager called Old Friends New Kicks that was super, super good. Should have gotten a growler of it. They had a red, white, and blue sour. It had boysenberries and currant and some other stuff in there. Wow Pop, a pale ale from them. Devil Up a Tree was a really tart saison. A Typo Negative was a beer that they brewed with beets. That was interesting. And that was really it for me. So a bunch of different stuff, but most of it from the same like two breweries.
Nice.
Was indeed. And now we move on to the Big 12, a league that that provides a lot of intrigue from like 1 through 7, and then not much else.
I think that's fair. I think the 1 through 7 have shifted a little bit thanks to like Iowa State.
Yeah. Go Clones.
And I think it depends on how you feel about Kansas State, which...
I always put them at number 7 because I always think that they're like that they're a Bill Snyder unfortunate health incident away from being pure garbage again.
Yeah, that's probably not unfair considering what happened when he tried to retire the first time.
Right.
Which was not for health reasons, I don't believe. It was just, you know, he felt like over he had it. Done his thing, and he had, and then they hired Ron Prince.
And then they turned back into frogs.
And then you have, I think at least like there's interesting storylines of all of these teams this year.
Yes.
1 through 10, honestly, because 10 is Kansas, and Kansas is going to fire David Beattie probably in, let's say, I'm gonna call week 6.
Let me check out the schedule.
I haven't looked at the schedule. I should probably do that, but that feels right, like mid-October. That's usually, I feel like week 6 is usually like when we get our first firings now.
Well, real talk, if they lose in week 1, he's done.
Who do they have? Do they have an FCS?
Nichols.
Oh, God. That'd be hilarious.
If they lose to Nichols, he's done. They're at
CMU.
CMU, Rutgers.
They could definitely lose.
Yeah, they could definitely lose.
I mean, they're 3-33 under him, and they weren't much better under Weiss. So this has just been – and they weren't much better under Turner Gill either. So this has just been just like an awful run of coaches for them. Like, it's just a very difficult job.
Problem is, like, why bother going through this anymore? Like, if you're them – Nichols is the only like win that you can probably count, and then everything else like CMU should be one of your easier opponents, and you have them on the road. You got Rutgers at home the next week, but like if you can't win 2 out of 3 against Central Michigan, Rutgers, and Baylor, that's it. You're dead. Like look at the rest of that schedule from Oklahoma State on down. Like they face their 4 easiest opponents on the season in the first 4 weeks, and like even Texas Tech, who's like the 5th easiest opponent, is on the road the week after.
And I'm not even
thinking about West Virginia.
Yeah, and I'm not even convinced they're going to be favored at like at Central Michigan. I think no. They probably will, but it's going to be
CMU
by a field goal, maybe.
Yeah, I think CMU is probably taking a step back even from what we saw last year.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean the Kansas will beat them.
This is also true.
And then Rutgers, like, you know, for all we may put of Rutgers, Rutgers is a much better team than Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
And Baylor should take a pretty big step forward this year. I don't think they'll be great, but yeah, I mean, they can't do much worse. And Rule's a good coach, so like, yeah, I'd be shocked if they won more than 2 games. Like, really shocked.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, this is what I hate about like the college coaching structure in particular. Like, if you go into the season knowing that it's a lost year, just screw it. Like, just call the season or or just like can a coach and move on. Like see what you've got on the roster in terms of actual coaching talent.
Well, the problem was that they had an AD who was clearly on the hot seat, and he wasn't going to make a move like that. And then he just got fired, and they hired Jeff Long today when we're recording on Thursday. So Beattie's basically dead man walking, as you'd expect already. But now there's a new AD. So, I mean, I think, honestly, like, unless he was to make a bowl, he'd be fired. Because if they were to win five games this year, that'd be a huge step forward.
Everybody's back.
Yeah, but they're all so bad.
I know, they are all so bad. But, like, that's the thing. Like, just can Beattie and let Doug Meacham take the reins and let's see what he can do.
That wouldn't be the worst idea, honestly.
we know Doug Meacham's a good coach.
Yeah, and he got, like, basically bribed to go there.
Exactly.
Like, legitimately, like, money, like, huge money for Kansas football. It honestly wouldn't shock me if Meacham ended up being the coach next year. Based on Beattie getting fired after, I mean, I said week six, it's probably earlier, honestly, if they're like 1-3 through three, through four, or maybe after the Oklahoma State game, because that'll probably be by, you know, a 70-point route. It wouldn't shock me if, like, Meacham took over and they maybe, like, stole a game somewhere or they just looked better. And like, what's the market for Kansas football?
There isn't one. I mean, that's the...
I wrote up Brett Bielema today because there's, you know, everyone said it. Which makes sense, because Long was, I couldn't remember the timeline, so I had to look it up before I read the article. Like, Long got fired, like, 9 days before Burt did, so he didn't fire him. And then, obviously, and then Bielema tweeted about it today, so clearly they still have a pretty strong relationship. So, honestly, Burt would be a pretty good hire for them.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that would be, that would be the best-case scenario, really, for them. I think Long obviously helps facilitate that a bit.
The question is if he wants to be back in college, which it seemed like he was kind of over it after getting fired from Arkansas. Now, you know, getting a head coaching offer is a big thing, but like it kind of seems like he's happy, like doing the like Patriots like helper out thing,
the Patriots whatever. Rehabilitation tour.
He's working for them somewhere. I don't know what his actual position is.
Well, the Pats do the same thing that Nick Saban does,
right?
Like, yeah, they give you like a year in exile and then you like bounce back.
Yeah, I just don't know. Like, I feel like he might just, like, ride the NFL out for a little bit. But it wouldn't shock me if Long hooked him up with, like, a really nice deal. And then you have a very interesting thing, and this is so hypothetical because who knows if it would even happen. But then you actually have an interesting thing where Kansas is trying to go against the Big 12 grain and be, like, one of the few slower teams, assuming he went back to, like, his Wisconsin style versus, like, what he was trying to do at Arkansas at the end, which I think might not be the worst idea.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good idea, really. I think that's my biggest fear for Syracuse in the ACC is that everyone else is kind of catching up to what Dino's throwing down. So I hope we can reach some sort of the potential before that happens. But that's a topic for another podcast.
Right.
You know, I think if Burt's over college football, like coincidentally Kansas is as well. So this could be a perfect marriage.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, like, hey, Burt, which I love that everyone just, like, knows that we're talking about Brett Bielema and his name's not Burt at all. Burt, like, we're not college football, we're Kansas. They're like the I can't believe it's not butter of Power 5.
It's not HBO.
it's not college football, it's Kansas. It's like if HBO was, like, what's, like, the worst possible network for television?
I mean, what did Spike TV turn into? No, TLC is the worst possible network for television at this point.
It's not TV, it's TLC, Kansas football, Jayhawks.
The artist formerly known as the Learning Channel that when they realized that nobody was learning anything on their network, they changed the name of the network to just be TLC. It just doesn't stand for anything anymore.
I always thought it was Tender Loving Care. But that also was not happening on that network. So.
No.
And again, Kansas football. It lines up, it works.
I'm with you.
I feel bad because like I felt like the David Beattie hire was like actually kind of forward thinking at the time.
Was.
They went full recruiting and like that wasn't the. I honestly don't think that was the worst idea. Just this job's so hard, it just didn't work out.
Well, it's hard, but then also like Beattie kind of like lost the plot a little bit by just saying like screw it, we're going JUCO, and like really kind of like pivoted to that quickly to fix it. And actually respect that, like, Dino hasn't necessarily gotten, like, itchy about it on Syracuse.
No, Dino's kind of just building it out as he wants to see it. Like,
right.
And I, the other problem is, like, when you're a Kansas school, like, the JUCOs are there, and that's how Kansas State did it. And that's how Kansas, when they were pretty successful, that's how they were doing it. It's just like, it's not a super easy thing to pull off. You can't have misses when you're recruiting JUCOs, and if you're going to build your team on them, like, you're going to have some misses, and then it becomes a whole problem because your depth just takes a huge hit.
I would agree. So looking at the top of this conference, Dan, I think people are more sold on Oklahoma than I necessarily am. You can prove me wrong. Feel free. I feel like any of the top four could win this conference, and I'm talking about Oklahoma, West Virginia, TCU, and Texas. Oklahoma's out-recruited all of them of late. I will admit that.
I agree. I think the problem is TCU and Texas are just like, we haven't seen them take that like step. I mean, TCU has been really good like in the recent past, but with this current roster, they've been kind of what they are. Texas obviously is like all on potential, and then West Virginia, they have the quarterback in Will Grier, but like they don't have the roster talent those other three do, where Oklahoma is so stacked top to bottom on the roster. I'm not totally sold on Oklahoma just like plugging in Kyler Murray and being exactly what they were with Baker Mayfield, which some people have seemed to have like weirdly.
Everybody's seemingly just accepted that. Like, you lost the guy who's like Heisman Trophy winner, and like it's the same thing with Louisville, where like everyone just expects Louisville to, like, yeah, you guys will be fine. Like, not necessarily. Like, it doesn't matter who you're replacing him with.
It's very easy to say Baker Mayfield's like an assistant quarterback. Like, having watched probably most of Baker Mayfield's starts the last couple of years, that dude was not a system quarterback. Like, he played within the system, but that man made some throws. Like, and it's just not going to be that easy for Kyler Murray to step in and do the exact same thing. And I think he's a super athlete, and he was really impressive when he did play last year. But it would be very shocking if he was, like, that close to what Mayfield did, because those numbers Mayfield put up last year were phenomenal. And it wasn't just, like, compiling numbers. Like, you watched him, and it was you knew you were watching a special player.
Oh, yeah, they put a video game nonsense. And, like, now, what, Oklahoma returns, like, about half of their offense and about half of their defense? I mean, that's par for the course for a blue blood, but at the same time, like, I just feel like there's a lot to replace here, and, like, there's just a bit too much for me to just, like, pencil them in as, like, oh, yeah, you're winning 12 games again, and you'll be in the playoff. Like, I don't know, like, West Virginia having Will Grier is the main reason why I like buy into them, but like West Virginia like seems like they're finally poised to like take that next step, and you know they host Oklahoma in the regular season finale in the Big 12.
And their defense has come along, like they're playing pretty opportunistically on that side of the ball. Grier's really good. I know he's been like floated as a possible number one pick. I don't know that he's that, but.
No.
He's a really good college quarterback. I mean, he proved it last year, and he proved it when he was at Florida. They haven't had a quarterback since.
Will Grier killed Florida.
That's been like the like that would have that really changed a lot for a lot of people. Is the Will Grier suspension of Florida? McElwain would probably still be there, and then Mullen's probably still at Mississippi State unless he takes like one of these other jobs, Tennessee or Arkansas or something. But yeah, so West Virginia is interesting. I just think like the talent level isn't where definitely Texas and Oklahoma are, probably not where TCU is. But you have probably the best quarterback in the league. So that makes up for a lot, assuming that Mark Murray isn't actually like Baker, like half Baker Mayfield, or one of the Texas quarterbacks doesn't like step into their blue chip pedigree.
Yeah, Texas is interesting. I do think they're a year away. I think they're just too young. Like on defense, they're there. That team is loaded with seniors on defensive end. I think you're seeing a lot more youth, though, in the offense that might make them a year away. I think look out for Texas next season. TCU might also be a year away, if only because like they do replace almost the entire offense. They don't really know what they're getting out of the quarterback position. It might be Sean Robinson, a quarterback. He's just a sophomore. Like, I think all four teams could win it, but realistically, it's probably between Oklahoma and West Virginia here, just in terms of like the talent in terms of the starting players on the roster. I think in terms of the talent on the overall roster, I think it's Oklahoma and then Texas a little bit further behind.
Yeah, I almost expect the Big 12 to be the odd conference out in the playoff picture this year. I'm not sold on Oklahoma being a 11 or 12 win team.
Same.
I think this to be a year where you have a couple teams with two losses playing for the conference title, and in all likelihood that will DQ the Big 12 from being in that four-team race, especially now that we have the precedent of a multi-conference or a multi-team representation from one conference at the SEC last year. So, yeah, I wouldn't pencil Oklahoma in to the playoff. Now, if Murray's really good, then it's a game changer, because then I think they're the clear favorite. But we have to see that, because like, he was awesome last year, but it was in garbage time against overmatched opponents. Right. So, yeah, we'll see. And it's also kind of like, it's not great for them. Like, Murray's a one-year guy. Like, you're essentially, you know, it's you're putting him in as like a senior for the first time versus like what they thought they had, which it's better than the alternative, him just going to baseball. But I also wouldn't like necessarily put Murray in as a starter in Penn. I wouldn't be, if it's close, I wouldn't be shocked if Austin Kendall won that job.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I mean, I think, you know, Murray comes in with the hype that he had coming out of high school and all, but yeah, like, you know, let's see who else on the roster. Do you think the most Big 12 thing to happen here would be like a three-way tie in second place or something? And then like,
yeah, like Kansas State wins 9 games out of nowhere.
Yeah, like out of nowhere, and then like beats Oklahoma in the championship game in Dallas.
That would be very Big 12. And then you get like a – what's the tiebreaker situation for like their championship game?
I believe after head-to-head, it's probably playoff ranking. Like
that
it used
sense.
To be.
I mean, that's what a lot of conferences are using.
That's how Texas Tech got screwed back in 08.
And it's a really dumb way to do it, considering it's like so – predicated on, I mean, I know the playoff rankings can change a lot week to week, but like what we saw with UCF last year, like if you're not starting high, like you're just not in, it's not exactly like the AP and the coaches, but right. you're always going to have inherent biases in some of these teams. So yeah, like the most Big 12 thing would definitely be like a four-way tie at the top, and then like two teams arbitrarily get through to the championship and they're not the right two.
Yeah, I completely buy that. I guess speaking of that, of the next four, and I'd say the next four, we're all pretty sold on Oklahoma State, K-State, Iowa State, and Texas Tech. Which of those teams randomly jumps up and wins like 8 or 9?
I love Iowa State. Like, I think last year they just were so much better than they should have been, and they were
got everybody back.
Yeah, like now you could sell me on regression to the mean a little bit, but I don't think they were like that lucky last year. I think they were just pretty good. Having watched a bunch of those games, like I think they were pretty legit, and they return everyone, and that should offset a lot of that. So I wouldn't be shocked if they won 8 or 9 games. I mean, looking at their schedule, they obviously have Iowa out of conference. They're at Kinnick, which is really tough. Kinnick is just eats highly ranked teams. I don't know how highly ranked Iowa State will be, but I'm sure the Iowa fans will be up for that. And then they have Oklahoma week 3, so that's a really tough back to back.
The first half of them is going to just dictate everything.
Yeah, I mean they. The first, I mean, through October 13th, like, it's about as tough a start as you can get. Obviously, you have Southern State and Akron in weeks 1 and 4, but aside from that, it's at Iowa, Oklahoma, and then you have that Akron game, and then at TCU, at Oklahoma State, and then versus West Virginia. And then it kind of cruise from there. Obviously, at Texas in November 17th isn't easy, and Kansas State to end the year isn't easy, but those first, like, 7 weeks will really kind of tell the tale here.
Totally. And you know what? Like you said, you don't really know how lucky they also could have been a little unlucky. Like looking at the scores, like they lost to Iowa by 3 in overtime. They lost to Texas by 10. Yes, they beat Oklahoma by 7, but like they also beat TCU by 7, but they lost to West Virginia by 4, Oklahoma State by 7. They lost to Kansas State by 1. Like,
yeah, so like those are how many coin flip losses.
Yeah, they could have been a 10-win team last year, and again bring most of those guys back. I mean, there's some key defenders missing, but like otherwise, like yeah, I could see Iowa State of all these teams. Like, I think that, you know, Campbell knows what the hell he's doing, and I think he's not going to be there after this year if they win.
If they win
seven or more, I think he's gone. But again, like, but I guess like to where we've talked about this before, like. He's not going to the SEC in all likelihood. The Big Ten jobs are pretty much filled for the time being.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's always, especially now, because these things move so quickly, there's always a job that opens that you don't expect. Yeah, I mean, there'll be a spot for him, especially because he is coming from, like, the Big 12. It wouldn't shock me if, like, I mean, what if Orgeron doesn't work out? Like, but Ellis, you look at a Dolly Campbell, a forward-thinking guy. It's a weird fit, but it wouldn't shock me. I mean,
LSU boosters wouldn't allow it.
Maybe not.
LSU boosters, though, like, there's no way that their next move isn't, like walk into the biggest Big 12 or ACC athletic department and like drag the guy out by his jacket and say you're coming
with
us.
They'll try to do what A&M did probably.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what they're
going to
do.
And just godfather offer someone.
Yeah.
I'm now pulling up the list of coaches where Matt Campbell could land. Like, it is a weird year because there aren't like a ton of obvious like moves up. There's like he wouldn't jump. Those weird whispers about like DJ Durkin because of stuff that happened this year, but I don't think he would jump up to Maryland. It's not really a big leap.
That's not really a move at all. And to be honest, you stand a better chance of getting to the Big 12 title game than you do the Big 10 title game from the East Division.
Yeah, I assume Maryland probably outbid them a little bit, but probably not that much. Because Maryland's not like super flush. Yeah, I'm looking like the Big 10's pretty stagnant. I can't imagine. And the schools that might lose their coach are not going to necessarily have a great chance of poaching a guy like Campbell. And then from there, like, Pac-12 is there. I mean, that whole, like, conference is relatively new. Now, maybe Arizona State gives up on Herm Edwards after 1 year, and that would be an interesting spot.
Bold.
Maybe, I don't know. I don't expect that to happen. I'm sure Herm will get at least two, probably, like, six, because that whole situation is so ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it. But you never know. I'm sure Campbell could find somewhere to go. I'm sure something will surprise somewhere. So I guess to close out, I know we talked about the teams that probably win the league. Dan, what do you think the Big 12 championship game is? The unnecessary Big 12 championship game.
I don't like doing this with divisions. It makes me uncomfortable. I'll go Oklahoma. Just by default, I don't think they're head over heels that much better than everyone. I think I'll do Oklahoma TCU. I trust Gary Patterson a lot, and I think that's just like kind of a differentiator. Where Texas, like you said, is probably a year away, but I do think I'm a top tournament fan. I think he will succeed there. I think he's probably still got another year. And then West Virginia, I just don't love beyond Greer. I think they're good. I don't think they're great. So I'll go with Oklahoma for the roster and TCU for the coach.
Yeah, I'll take Oklahoma to win it, but like, while West Virginia does have like its toughest games at home, that's also a problem. It also has some games that are like toss-up-ish on the road, you know, like Iowa State, Texas, Oklahoma State, like those are all road games, and those are all in the back half of the schedule. Like, to me, that spells a recipe for disaster. You just can't be that on for that many weeks in a row. And having that sort of gauntlet, like, to kind of run through to end the season, like, doesn't matter how experienced you are, doesn't matter how good you are, like, most teams are going to trip up. And I think you could see some weird scenario where West Virginia owns the tiebreaker over maybe both TCU and Oklahoma, but loses their chance in the championship game because they picked up too many losses elsewhere.
Oh, we can only hope. I'm all for just Big 12 championship shenanigans because it's super funny that they have this team at all.
Yeah, I also hate West Virginia. So, really, that's them losing is fine to me.
Fair enough.
Anyway, so yeah, that was it for us. Next week we are talking Big Ten. So
I like that you've jumped Pac-12 just ahead of a bunch of these conferences.
That's because because I do it in order of my favorite leagues. This is not the Bill C situation where I go league by league based on how good or bad they were. This is literally the ones I want to talk about the most are backloaded. ACC, obviously.
I'm surprised Big Ten wasn't this week then. I would rather talk about Big 12 and Big 10.
I thought about it, but I just figured like there's so many more teams. There's so much more nonsense that goes on in the Big 10.
That's true. The Big 12, you can kind of like, we touched on everyone like at least a little bit in like not that long. So I get it.
Yeah. Well, it'll be Big 10, then SEC, then Pac-12, who always owns my late night activities out here. And then ACC will be broken down to divisions after that.
Sounds good. We are making our way through summer.
We are indeed. Hopefully not too quickly, because
we're ahead of schedule, so we have some time to play with, which is nice.
I like it. All right, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Trains and Appaloo Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, on whatever other service you may listen to, and go Orange.
Go Orange.